God designed the home. Genesis 1 to 3, we see him making man and woman, and they were to establish this family. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and cling to his wife. And we see at the very beginning, God institutes the family, and it's to be a place of love, place of safety, where Christian values are modeled, belief systems are formed. In Christian families, children are to learn of their value to God. God gave us earthly fathers and mothers to be his hands and feet, to make it easy to believe that God is loving because that's what they've experienced by their mom and dad. I often say that the greatest thing a father can do is make it easy for their children to believe in God, their father. You achieve that, that's a great achievement. And when I say Christian home, I don't just mean in name. Boy, have I met Christian homes over the years that I just shudder at. I say, how did this happen? Christian home is not just because we go to church. I'm speaking of a place where Christ is Lord, where the fruit of the Spirit is evident, where all are surrendering their will to Jesus and growing in his likeness, where that home is salt and light to others. And we read about this kind of a home in Ephesians 5 and 6. In chapters 5 and 6, Paul is talking about the relationship of those in the family. Chapter 5, it's about husbands, how they're to love their wives, and wives are to respect their husbands. But in chapter 6, he turns directly to children and their parents. Verse 1, chapter 6, verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may go well with you and you may enjoy long life on earth. Verse 4 is of particular interest. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. There's a mirror passage in Colossians chapter 3, and it says some of the same things about wives and husbands and children obeying. And in verse 21, it changes the word just a hair, but it says, fathers, do not embitter your children, or they will become discouraged. I want to talk today about this subject of the Christian home. Now, there's two items of interest in that verse 4 that I spoke of. And the first item of interest to me is that it speaks to the fathers, and there's no mention to the mothers. And we would not suggest that mothers aren't insignificant. Obviously, they are. But here's one of those many scriptures where it speaks of the responsibility and the authority of the fathers. And it's important in an era where fathers are often missing from the raising up of the children, training and instructing them in the Lord. And so here's this specific command to the fathers, raise them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. And the second thing that interests me about this passage is there's only one item that's brought to the surface, one negative item chosen for fathers to be alert to. And if I would have taken a survey and you did not know these two passages, and I would have said, what's one of the biggest things a Christian father needs to watch out for? Would you have said, well, that they don't exasperate their children, or they don't embitter? The King James Version says, provoke your children to wrath. Causing anger in our children is the one thing that Paul brings up twice in these passages. And so I suggest to you that must be important. Out of all the things he could have said, he chooses this one thing. You know, usually in conversation, I hear people remark about how angry the children are making the parents. Here, Paul's concern is that the parents are making the children angry. Now, again, this just isn't a dad's issue. My ex-brother-in-law was physically beaten many, many times as a boy by his abusive dad. But he told us that his greatest challenge, his greatest anger, was towards Mom, who watched it happen and didn't intervene. So no one gets off the hook here, but here's this passage, where the focus is stated positively, train and instruct your children in the Lord, and negatively, don't exasperate or provoke them. And so this is one of the passages where, again, I see that it's our first responsibility is to disciple our children. What good is it if you're a Sunday school teacher to other people's children and you're provoking anger and embittering your own? And I said it, it was said to me, and I say it often to the young pastors that I associate with, your first congregation is your family. Your first responsibility is to train and instruct your children in the Lord, and then the others. So let's grapple some today with the meaning of this. Creating anger, unrest, extreme frustration, discouragement. That was Colossians added that word when he said, don't embitter your children or they'll become discouraged. And let's just see how easily it's done, how we fall prey to bad habits, and need to be alert, a constant vigilance. So I'd say to all the dads here, it's your responsibility, yes, along with your wife, your responsibility to train and instruct your children in the Lord. And that involves not doing things that would cause them to become embittered. I'm very grateful to two friends in my early parenting who helped me to see some blind spots in my own life. I've shared these with you at other times, and so I won't go into detail. But my college roommate had come to visit us and watched my actions, and he said, you know, Jim, no doesn't have to be loud to mean no. I was doing that escalating thing. No. No. And my kids learned that it wasn't until up here that they had to really pay any attention. Another, my sister, actually, niece, watched my parenting. I wonder if she had kids of her own at that time. But she rightfully said, Jim, you don't call your children stupid. You would never use that word. But sometimes your actions are conveying and saying that to them, that they're stupid. Wow. And both of those, I realized, were true. And I was grateful that somebody would speak that into my life. When I was thinking about biblical examples, I couldn't think of a lot, but, you know, for 30, 35 minutes of preaching, you don't want me to have a lot of examples. But there were two very, very apparent ones and of parenting that provoked anger in their children. And one was Isaac and Rebekah, where Isaac, we're told, favored Esau, and Rebekah favored Jacob. And so you've got this family dynamic where the kids aren't treated fair. Mother likes one better. Dad likes the other better. In fact, you remember the story, Rebekah actually helps Jacob steal the birthright. She knew that Isaac, you'll forgive me if I get all those whichever ones, but Isaac, the dad, was going to give the birthright, and he had sent Esau out to hunt and get a deer and fix his favorite venison stew, and Mom said, hey, let me put some, I can season it just right, I know how he likes it, and you take it in and get the birthright. Well, Dad will know that it's not me, and she said, well, we'll put skins on your arms. And they went all out, and she did. She helped him cheat Esau out of his birthright. So look at what we read later. What that caused to happen in Esau. Now, Esau learned that Isaac had blessed Jacob and had sent him to Padan Aram to take a wife from there, and that when he blessed him, he commanded him, do not marry a Canaanite woman. And that Jacob had obeyed his father and mother and had gone there. Esau then realized how displeasing The Canaanite women were to his father Isaac, so he went to Ishmael and married Mahalath, the sister of, well, these names, daughter of Ishmael, in addition to the wives he already had. So when he learned that his mother didn't and dad didn't want him to do it, that's exactly what he did out of spite. And so here's a son who is acting out of the anger that was provoked in him from being treated unfairly as a young man. The other one is that was real apparent is David and Absalom. It's quite a story where Absalom has killed his stepbrother Amnon in revenge for the rape of his sister. And after he did that, he went into hiding. And in 2 Samuel 13, we read this. Absalom fled and went to Talmai, son of... Man, I got a lot of names in these. But King David mourned for his son every day. Absalom fled and went to Geshur. He stayed there 3 years. David's mourning every day. And the spirit of the king longed to go to Absalom, for he was consoled concerning Amnon's death. Three years. They're separated. Absalom's in hiding. And David mourned for his son every day and longed to go see him. So under some circumstances, Absalom was invited back to Jerusalem. But for 2 years, David doesn't send for him. So Absalom thinks he's coming home to be restored to his father, and his father doesn't even talk to him or call him into his presence. 3 plus 2 is 5 years. 5 years of something growing inside. 5 years of distance. 5 years in that time, the heart of Absalom changed. And he conspires against his father and takes away the kingdom from him. And this failed relationship never recovers. So I want to give some ideas today about how do we train up our children in a way that doesn't exasperate and embitter them. All right? So I'm going to give you my 10. They're not necessarily in any order. I guess they're in the order that I wrote them down. I notice sometimes you guys get your phones, you just take those, click those pictures, that's pretty good. Or I could mail these out to you sometime if somebody said, hey, if one person said, I'd like those 10, I probably would mail them out. But here are some things that you can use in your own family, your grandchildren. You can use as your good neighbors in your neighborhood. Somebody at work says to you, man alive, I'm having trouble with my kids. And here are some things that I think contribute to why we provoke anger, that our children are actually acting out. Maybe Absalom is, in his 40s? He's acting out of this anger. Esau, the same thing. So, first of all, let me give you the wrong answer. Some people think that the answer to this, the way you don't embitter your children, is you don't make the children do anything they don't want, and then when they're old enough, they can decide for themselves. So I just ask you, would that work with education? Dad, I don't want to go to school today. Well, son, you don't have to. And when you're old enough to decide, you can choose whether you want to go to school or not. Would it work for dental care, John? Would you suggest that would be the way to handle dental care in your family? Well, I know you don't like to go to the dentist, so we won't make you. And when you're 21, you can decide if you want to do dental care or not. Exercise, food choices. We could have a long list of places in life where we say it doesn't work there. We have to, for a child's good, insist on some things in their life. And so I noticed that my friend who told me that, as I urged him to get his kids into Sunday school, he said to me, well, you know, we don't want to influence our children like that. We want to just let them do as they choose, and then when they get old enough, they can decide for themselves. Fortunately, they had a praying mother who helped rescue some of the situation. Number two, practice the rules we enforce. We place ourselves under the same discipline of training that we ask of our children. So we set the example. And you and I both know for somebody to smoke or chew or do some other destructive attitude, habit, and then say to their children, "Now, son, don't do as I do, do as I say." You know, that's never going to work. So one of the things about life is for us to intentionally think about the rules we're setting down and saying to ourselves, how do we live by those same rules? We're going to monitor screen time. Do we monitor that for ourselves? If we're insisting they exercise, do we exercise? Do we practice the things that we preach to them? Number three, is that children and families need both soft and tough love. So avoid the severity and rigidity that fails to communicate love. And sometimes the church in the past has been good with the rules, but the rigidity and severity of them didn't communicate the love that was behind them. A.B. Simpson, who founded the Christian Missionary Alliance, was raised in a rigid Presbyterian upbringing. And every time I tell this, I just picture myself as an 11-year-old boy. And Sunday afternoons were spent being grilled in the Westminster Catechism. I think there's 400 and some questions. The first one is, "What is the chief end of man?" Dad would ask. And A.B. and his sisters and brothers would answer, "To glorify God and enjoy Him forever." And so all afternoon was spent being grilled like this. There was very little joy in the process. And could you just picture this 11-year-old boy looking out the window and seeing the sun shining and other kids playing ball and whatever, and he's learning the Westminster Catechism? Martin Luther's father was so stern and severe that he struggled his whole life praying "Our Father." Some of you understand that, don't you? The word "father" stood for nothing but severity. The duty of a parent is to discipline, but it's also to encourage. Luther said this, "Spare the rod and spoil the child is true, but beside the rod, keep an apple to give him when he does well." I like that. I'm just a thought just came to my mind. I don't know what I think of the hug and the warmth and that after you've spanked your child. I understand the good intent. I guess I'm thinking as a child. I'm not sure that's the time I really want to be hugged and cuddled. Let me go lick my wounds a little bit. Then let's come. I don't. Some of you might have that practice. You can tell me how you think it works. Number four, praise our children regularly and frequently. I've met some families who think that if you give praise and appreciation, it will lead to pride. And that's not really correct. Do you remember that Dorothy Knoll poem from the 1970s? A lot of truth to it. If children live with criticism, they learn to condemn. If they live with hostility, they learn to fight. If children live with ridicule, they learn to be shy. If children live with shame, they learn to feel guilty. If children live with encouragement, they learn confidence. If children live with tolerance, they learn to be patient. If children live with praise, they learn to appreciate. If children live with acceptance, they learn to love. If children live with approval, they learn to like themselves. If children live with honesty, they live truthfulness. If children live with security, they learn to have faith in themselves and others. If children live with friendliness, they learn the world is a nice place in which to live. Now, I'll tell you why I don't agree that you should avoid praise, because it can contribute to pride, and that would simply be because the Bible tells us we're to praise one another. We're to honor one another. We're to bless one another. We're to praise, the men are to praise their women in the city gates. Praise their wives. That works better if you're praising your wife in the city gates and not somebody else's. And thank you. I just realized I said plural, didn't I? Well, I have five women in my life. You know, two daughters, granddaughters. Actually, man, I have 10 granddaughters. So I got a lot of women in my life to praise. And the scripture says we're supposed to. And if you have problems receiving praise, can I just say get over it? Because the Bible commends that others are to praise you, not your own lips. And so we're to accept it, because the Bible, it's kind of like when it says it's more blessed to give than receive. So it's great for you to give, but it's important for you to be a good receiver and let others have those blessings as well. John Newton said, "I know that my father loved me, but he did not seem to wish me to see it." That's kind of sad. It's really sad. Five, do not discipline out of anger. What's the problem with disciplining out of anger? Somebody want to throw that out? What's the problem with that? In anger, you may do things that aren't appropriate to the situation or to the crime, and you can't take them back. Somebody else. Okay, and let me add a third. It's all about you, not about them, and it's not about the subject that you're trying to teach. It's not about the integrity and the character. Okay, anybody else want to throw another out? Excuse me, what? Oh, yeah, right. And so what is the lesson then? Yeah. So the lesson becomes not learn to do right. The lesson becomes learn not to make dad and mom mad. And we're very inconsistent. And inconsistent doesn't teach right and wrong. It teaches don't make mom and dad angry. Number six, keep your promises. Again, I don't want to retell my stories over and over, so just allude to it. But one of the most significant events in my life was when Dad made a promise to me about hunting. I was in either fourth, fifth, sixth, because it was when we lived in Oskaloosa, fourth to sixth grade. And I wasn't allowed to go on this trip. He said, "I didn't know you wanted to, but one day, Jim, you and I will go out just by ourselves." And I took that to heart. And the day that he did, it's one of the greatest days of my childhood. It made me feel that I was important, as opposed to when we don't keep our promises, we make our children feel like they're not really important. One thing that I wish I had done a little more is number seven, and that's to recognize the personality types of your children. And the Five Love Languages is a great book to help you see that some kids respond to words, to service, to touch, to gifts, to time. I kind of had an attitude that went like this. I love you, you know that, and I just treat you all the same. And then I learned later that adults, that there are certain things that mean a lot more, so that we know that our son Andy just relishes time. I go to his house, and I'm saying, "What's the project? We want to build that closet downstairs. You want me to help you with a yard sale because you're going to move?" And sometimes when we get all done and we work like that, you know what he told me one of his favorite times was visiting? It was the year I went and I got sick. And I spent the whole time sitting on the couch, kind of just, you know, moping around like you do when you're sick. And we just spent time in the kitchen, in the living room, just sitting and talking and being together. You don't want me to do a project every time? Some of the other kids, they want they service is their thing. And if I serve them, touch, non-sexual touching, words, service, non-sexual touching, gifts, and time. Every child needs time. In fact, if you said, how do you spell love, it's spelled T-I-M-E, all right? When Henry Brooks was 8, he recorded in his diary the day he had spent fishing with his dad. Here's what he wrote. Went fishing with my father today, the best day of my life. It was so special as a day that he talked and wrote about that day for the next 30 years. Unfortunately, his dad also kept a journal, and he wrote on that day, went fishing with my son, a wasted day. Perhaps there was no fish. Certainly, he was blind to the importance that day had to his son. Number 8, understand age limitations and possibilities. One of the worst things we can do is not have a good balance of expectations. Too many expectations, unreachable expectations, just frustrate. No expectations? I don't want to see that room. So where's the balance of having reasonable expectations? It's important. Maybe that's a dialogue that you have with your mate or somebody else. Number 9, incorporate your teaching into daily life. One of the great Old Testament passages is Deuteronomy 6. I use it at nearly every child dedication, so some of you know it by now, that the Lord our God is one God, and we're to love the Lord with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then he says that I command you to teach it to your children when you're walking on the path, when you're lying down at bed at night. Bind them as what, Jonathan? Whatever they are, on your, put them on your shirts and wear it on your T-shirts and put it on your wall so that a part of your everyday life is communicating about God. When's the best time to teach the magnitude of God? In a good church worship service? I think not. I think maybe when you're standing on top of a mountain. When you're lying under the stars, that's the time to read Psalms 8, 5, 6, 7, 8 in there. Oh God, what is man that you're mindful of him? When I see the heavens, the work of your hand. That's the time to talk about that. Not in a Sunday school class. It's okay then. Fishing a crystal clear stream. I think I learned more about integrity fishing and hunting with my dad than any of the sermons that he preached. I remember the day it wasn't bass season yet, and we were fishing for northern pike, and he caught a trophy bass, and without hesitation, picked it up, slid it back into the water, and said, well, the season's not open yet for bass. I have often wondered how it would have impacted my life had in some of those teaching moments, my dad said, well, we just won't tell the fishing game about this one. We'll have it eaten before anybody even knows. But instead, in daily life, he and my mom and others taught us about the Christian life. And number 10, express your pleasure. Some parents are impossible to please. I didn't know I was that way. I've been hearing a little bit about it lately from my son who writes books. You want to know the only thing worse than having your children come and talk to you about their flaws or your flaws is to have them write a book about your flaws. You know, Nick is trying so hard to say to us, look, you were wonderful parents. I loved you. But you weren't perfect. And to that, I have to agree. I never made any pretense that I was perfect. But I didn't know that he was growing up feeling like I was impossible to please. I thought I was just setting the bar a little higher that he could, with just a little more work, he could become a little more than what he was. So it's a good one to learn about. If we're making it, no matter how hard someone tries, that it won't be good enough. That's not a good thing. So I remember talking to a young man in our church who was really quite a budding artist. And I said, I noticed, though, you have trouble finishing your paintings. He would show me a painting. It would be 95% done, I'd say. And then he would go on to another one. And I started to see this pattern. And I said, what's the deal? He said, well, I can't bring myself to finish a painting. Why is that? Because when I do, I'll hear my dad say, it's not good enough. And so all the time he's doing it, he's enjoying it. The artist in him is coming out. But he doesn't want to reach that point that the words of his dad are going to say, you're not good enough. Howard Hendricks said, the hardest thing for a child to resist is the displeasure of a parent who has built a strong relationship with him. That's kind of thought-provoking, isn't it? You know that there's only a few times in the New Testament where the Scripture records God speaking to the Son. Only a handful. And two of them, one at the baptism and one at the transfiguration, God says the same thing. He says, this is the Son who I love, with whom I am well pleased. Again, I like to try to imagine, what could God have said to his Son? I mean, it's a big world. And there's a lot of things he could have said to Jesus on those moments. But what he chooses to say is, I love you and I'm pleased with you. That was actually the message I was working on when my dad was killed in a car accident. Because I had received that from him. And just coincidentally, I was working on that passage and putting my thoughts together when I got the call. I'm not the only one who was raised in a good home. Some of you, when I speak of the home that I was raised in, it's so different from yours. I understand that. But literally, when I was floundering as an 18 and 19-year-old, and I was wondering, is there really a God? Is all of this true? Is the Bible something I can rely on? There was a reality in my life that I could not escape. I couldn't go down that path very far because I had seen the reality of God in my mom and my dad. Their mutual respect, their kindness, their love of people, their concern to help the less fortunate, the way that my mom and dad worked tirelessly to serve the Lord, those and many other things made me want to follow that. I lived in a generation where a lot of church Christian homes were losing their children. Young people were abandoning their faith. I was asked about that once, and I just thought, rebel? Why would I want to rebel? My parents, the Christian home I was raised in, was what I wanted to become. I didn't want to rebel. So I want to encourage you today. It's not about being perfect, but it is about being constantly vigilant in our lives. Are we training and instructing our children in the Lord? That was the command. Do it. And one of the ways that we do it is by being alert to this elephant that's in the room, that often we're creating anger and frustration and embittering our children. So it's places for us to take to the Lord and pray and say, Lord, what do you want to do in me? What do you need to do in my life so that I can be effective in influencing my children for God? God created the Christian home as a place of safety and love and growth. And I pray that you'll truly have one and that our church will be able to help you have one. You understand that the few hours we have of your family cannot undo. We can't do for you what you must do in your Christian home yourself. But it's our great desire to come alongside you and help you and be part of helping you to be that Christian family. Let's pray together. Thank you, Lord, for this day, the opportunity to search out the scriptures, to share from experiences of my life and Christians from many generations. And I pray that we'll be able to positively impact people within our home, neighbors, co-workers, those around us. For the sake of Christ and eternity, we pray this.